Two perspectives on the war in Iraq today. The first from our Iraqi correspondent in Baghdad, Ahmed Abdullah. A few days ago, Ahmed was working at his office when a citywide curfew was imposed. So he was there with one other man, neither could leave, and the missiles were coming in.
So here we are, me and him, a Sunni and a Shiite stuck in the same place, not knowing when we will die. And this made me think, will people know which is which?
The other perspective today comes from the father of a son who's serving in Iraq. A son who told his father that he narrowly avoided getting hit when missiles came into his base.
For him, it was just a very sad experience because somebody was killed during that missile attack about 20 yards from him. But, of course, we didn't learn this until 2 days later when he called. And by then, he was already moving on, you know, on another night exercise. It was such old news to him that he didn't even really recognize, you know, the impact of mom and dad sitting at home going, oh, my God, was our son hit, wounded, killed.
One war, two personal perspectives, and one overriding wish for peace. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
5 years ago, President George Bush stood in the Rose Garden and addressed the nation about the new war in Iraq.
Our victory in Iraq is certain, but it is not complete. Today, the world is safer. The terrorists have lost an ally. The Iraqi people are regaining control of their own destiny. These are good days for the history of freedom.
Ahmed Abdullah is one of the Iraqis who'd be well within his rights to ask, 5 years later, whatever happened to those good days in the history of freedom? He and others were noting recently that the quality of life for people in Baghdad had been getting better. But now he tells us, in his latest entry in Ahmed's diary, that things are back to the way they were before.
I want to talk today about the fighting that's been taking place recently in Iraq. There's been a lot of trouble in Basra, a city in the south. That's where a lot of Iraq's oil is. This time, it was the Shiites and Muqtada al-Sadr Mehdi army fighting against another Shiite militia in Basra. They were fighting the Badr militia, the strike force of the ruling party. This tells me that the violence in Iraq is not always sectarian as everyone thinks. In this fight, it was Shiite against Shiite. They were fighting over money from oil smuggling, millions of dollars. And while things seem quiet now, that fighting can start up again at any minute. After Basra, the fighting started again in Baghdad. Soon after that, the government started a curfew here. You know that I work as a reporter, so I was trapped in the office for 4 days. My telephone didn't stop ringing, stringers calling and sending emails and text messages to give me the news, and I can hear the sounds of explosions and gunshots through the phone. And in Baghdad, showers of mortars and clashes, columns of smoke, sounds of sirens and explosions. It felt too close, and every time I hear the mortar fall, I think that the next one will hit us. It was too much. I was trapped in the office with another man named Mudaffar. He is a Shiite. And we were both getting the news, translating it and sending it. He's 23, young and strong, full of hope, and he smiles all the time. He also seems very Iraqi, a man who loves his country more than anything. Every now and then, I turn my head toward him and try to read the expressions on his face while talking on the phone. He managed to hide his feelings for some time, and I can understand why. It was his people fighting each other. But in the end, he couldn't. One day, I saw that he was about to cry. So I asked him why. And he said, I wish they all burn and go to hell. And I said, who? And he answered, the militias, They are the reason of all what is happening. They have fooled us with their talk about the sect and religion. They are who made us kill each other. You see, being a Shiite in Iraq doesn't always mean that you agree with what the militias are doing. There are millions of Shiites who disagree with them. So here we are, me and him, a Sunni and a Shiite stuck in the same place, not knowing when we will die. And this made me think, will people know which is which? Which one of us is a Sunni or a Shiite? Or they will just say that two Iraqi journalists have died in this place. Two Iraqi journalists. After 4 days, the curfew ended and I gave Muzaffar a lift back home, just like any two brothers or friends. We were both driving in the streets of Baghdad, with eyes full of tears, seeing what happened to it. I am 20 years older than Muzaffar, so I was telling him about what I remember about these parts of Baghdad, and he just looked without talking. Months ago, we were all saying that the violence in Baghdad started to drop. We were all feeling a little bit safe again. But still, there were explosions and killings and assassinations. I was thinking that it is funny, the way we define safety here. Because really, the violence never stopped, and I think that it never will. What we are telling ourselves is nothing but a way to make us continue moving forward. The way we define safety goes like this. The area that has less killing is the safest. In any other country in the world, this will sound crazy, but not in Baghdad. Because for us, it is a sign of hope. So here we are driving in Baghdad, Muzaffar and me. We both had the same look in our eyes. I felt that we were apologizing to each other for what happened, just like if we were the ones who did it. He is a Shiite, and I'm a Sunni. But in the end, we are Iraqis, and this is our country. We are destroying it, and we must find a way to build it again.
Ahmed Abdullah lives in Baghdad. You can listen to all the different stories he's filed for Ahmed's diary. Just go to thestory.org. It's never hard to hear the frustration in Ahmed's voice, his wish to see an end to the conflict, his hope someday to have his family back together. Same thing is happening here in the U.S. Steve Wright sent his son to Iraq as part of the troop surge in Baghdad. Like Ahmed, Steve is also a journalist, and he wrote about the experience for his newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News. Steve's son was 18 when he went to Iraq. His dad drove him to the airport.
It was a very quiet ride. I mean, normally we would be talking, laughing, listening to a CD, but he kind of sat in the back seat, very quiet in his desert fatigues with his backpack next to him. We got to the airport, you know, and we couldn't go through security. And so we kind of stood in the lobby there at the airport. You know, we were crying and hugging, and it was very clear that he was headed off to Iraq. After my son made his way down the hallway, one of the ticket counter folks came over and said, "I didn't know he was leaving for Iraq. We could have gotten you through and you could have seen him to the gate." But at that point, we were all emotionally drained. But it was very sad watching your son walk down the hallway, backpack on, desert fatigues, heading off to war.
And I guess not long after that, Steve, you had to go back to your office as an editor at the San Jose Mercury News. Were you looking at how that experience, seeing a son off to war, had changed your own perspective as a journalist?
Yes, because, you know, a lot of times as a journalist, we're a little bit more on the sideline. This put me front and center into the debate about the war, it made it not just personal for me, but it made it personal for my entire editorial page team, and it made it personal for our entire newsroom. Most of the people in the newsroom had no connection with anybody who had a son or a daughter in the Army, much less in the war.
And how did it change things like an editorial page meeting, or how did it change in the newsroom?
Well, it didn't change so much our position on the war, because our position on the war had always been the same. But I think we reacted more quickly when milestones were reached, when it was 3,000 dead, when it was 4,000 dead. I think we ran a few more editorials than we would have, challenging the cost of the war, et cetera.
Were you seeing people in any way tiptoe around you, Steve, rather than saying, we did an Iraq story yesterday, we don't want one today? I mean, be careful not to say that kind of cavalier thing in front of you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And I would say there was some tiptoeing, but I had to be very careful about that. I mean, as a senior editor at the paper, I certainly didn't want my personal experience to influence coverage. So there was some tiptoeing, because I thought our paper should run, as the New York Times does and a few other papers, the name and the state of every soldier who was killed. And for one reason or another, they decided not to do that over on Newsside. And they didn't really get back to me except to say, thanks for the suggestion. And it kind of died on the vine.
Steve Wright says that on a more personal level, seeing his son off to war has been hard on him and his wife. Neither he nor his wife ever believed in the need for this war, but Steve also says that his son was equally determined to be a soldier. And that's been hard for all of them. More with Steve Wright in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Earlier on today's program, our correspondent in Baghdad, Ahmed Abdullah, was talking about life in a war 5 years on.
I was thinking that it is funny the way we define safety here. Because really, the violence never stopped, and I think that it never will. The way we define safety goes like this. The area that has less killing is the safest. In any other country in the world, this will sound crazy.
Steve Wright would almost certainly agree with that. Until just recently, Steve was the editorial page editor of the Mercury News in San Jose, California. He was opposed to the war in Iraq. He is still opposed to the war in Iraq, but now he has a son who's fighting there. And his perspective has shifted. I asked Steve to take me back to the time when his son first turned his interest to becoming a soldier.
He was pretty much an average Californian kid. He spent a lot of time with guitar in a rock band. He loved performing. He loved writing songs. And I thought, okay, great. When he graduates from high school, maybe he'll be able to take a couple years and really take a go at being a rock star, if that's what he wanted to be.
Now, I know a lot of parents who wouldn't be too happy about a son or daughter becoming a rock star.
Yeah. Well, when you have the band practicing in your garage for 3, 4, 5 years, you really see the dedication of the kids. And I could just tell that that was one of his passions.
What was the first time that your son said to you that he was thinking of becoming a soldier?
Maybe 9th or 10th grade. He has an uncle who was in the Army, and he really spent a lot of time talking to him about the Army and discipline and leadership.
What did you think?
Well, my wife and I kind of ignored it. we were hoping that was just a passing fad. And I think we missed a lot of cues because of that. We weren't really as clued into what was building for him. There were often times where we had conversations that, frankly, just did not end very well, where you both kind of get to shouting and you kind of realize, okay, we're talking on different levels here and not hearing each other. When he started really getting serious about the Army, he was connected to a recruiter. And so that's when we knew that he was serious about the Army and that the Army was going to be serious about him. And he had said he was going to do it. And I had been talking to him about, well, why not take a year off? Why not travel the world? Why not backpack through Europe? And he kept saying, Dad, you're not listening. Dad, you're not listening. I want to join the Army.
Steve Wright says when he looks back now, he realizes that his son's determination was set during his sophomore year in high school. His history class went to Washington, D.C.
He really came back from that trip just buoyed by what he saw in terms of memorials, in terms of the service of individuals, in terms of what our country stood for. And then he had a very moving moment at the Vietnam Memorial. He later told us that somebody had left a Purple Heart at the bottom of the memorial. And to him, that somebody would do that and would see all those names of people who had sacrificed themselves in service to the country, just when he recounted that experience, he had tears coming down from his eyes. I mean, he wasn't really crying, but The tears were just streaming of somebody who was really going through an emotional connection. And when that happened, my wife and I, we started tearing up. And that was really the key moment when we realized that he was called to be a soldier.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Steve Wright says that he was there when his son signed up.
We did not want to sign for him to join early, and we would not let him test out of high school. But right when he turned 18, I was very supportive of going with him to the base where you do the sign up here in California. And it was a surprising experience for me, because out of the 30 or 40 young people that were in there waiting to sign up, there was only one or two parents, and I was one of them. And then here were these kids making huge decisions for their lives. And I realize not every parent can afford time off or can have flexible time to do that, but that many kids being there with only two parents was surprising.
And pretty soon after high school, then straight to basic training.
Yes. I mean, you know, he was the kind of kid, though, who had worked part-time jobs, and he was a barista at Starbucks before he entered. And so the summer after high school, he earned a little bit more money at Starbucks and then was going to delay his entry even longer just so that he could do a little bit more rock and roll. But in September, really felt that he wanted to get going. And so we signed up, and I went in. And it was funny because I tried to negotiate with the Army recruiters at the base. I said, come on, can't you give them, you know, some extra bonus pay? And those guys don't move much off the table, I'll tell you.
No was the answer, I gather.
Yes, exactly.
How did he like basic training?
Well, it's very surprising to me because he's about 5'9", and in basic training he was 130 pounds. And I thought, oh, man, this poor guy, he's going to be just physically taxed, although I thought he could do fine on the mental. But, you know, he grew up a middle-class lifestyle where the hardest work he ever did probably was help me trim a tree. And in basic training, you're not allowed to have cell phones or make calls out. Everything has to be done through written letter. And his letters would just come back to how he was enjoying it, what was the camaraderie. He had some leadership opportunities. It wasn't all a piece of cake. He wasn't saying he was loving it, but I have heard from many others who just hated basic training. But he really was resilient through that. And interestingly, his nickname that the drill sergeant gave him was Mighty Mouse. And when you think of all the names that soldiers can get in basic training, Mighty Mouse is not a bad one.
Once out of basic training, Steve's son put his name in for service in Korea, and he was accepted. But around that time, the Pentagon and the White House were putting together plans for the troop surge in Iraq. Steve says he was in his office at the San Jose Mercury News when he got the call that his son was going to Iraq.
I started crying initially. I remember I was at work. I had to leave my office, go outside to an area where I could walk around, take deep breaths, get some tears out. He was going to be putting his life on the line. I knew that I may not see him again. You know, I have so many parents whose kids go off to college or to different things, and it's so easy for them to stay in touch with their kid. They're allowed to have cell phones if your kid's in college and you're able to reach him. And I knew I would not be able to have that kind of contact with him and would not know what he was doing, how safe he was, where he was. You know, my wife and I were basically numb.
Steve Wright has found that the stress of not knowing where his son is or was or what he's doing was one of the hardest things for him to get used to.
My son is a cavalry scout, and a cavalry scout does a lot of stuff, but it's kind of frontline infantry. So he was doing stuff like making neighborhood sweeps, going through buildings. For a number of months, he drove a Humvee and then graduated to driving a Bradley tank. He, at one point, you know, chased down a few insurgents into a home where there were rifles. I know he's been shot at, and I know that he's fired back. I know that he's been on bomb disposal. Just his regular life there is constantly about war and being fired upon. One thing he told my wife in his last phone call with us this week was that he is tired of always having to wonder about his safety or whether he's going to be killed. So now I know it's time for him to come home because he had never talked that way in the past year. And I can see what 14 months of being under regular fire, you know, living out of tanks, living in dust during the summer, hot dust, and in monsoons, and never knowing when somebody's going to fire on you, it takes its toll. And I'm glad they're going to go back to one-year deployments instead of the 15 months.
And he's what, 19, 20 years old?
Well, he turned 19 when he was there. He turned 19 in July, so he was actually there for about 3 or 4 months when he was 18, which is pretty young to be sent there.
Yeah, I agree with that. I wonder if in your role as a news person, you ever saw a story unfolding in the area where your son was and thought to yourself, how can I find out if he's okay?
The one that sticks out most in my mind is my wife and I were at the mother-in-law's house, and they had Fox News on kind of in the background. And we heard the name of his forward operating base, you know, just kind of out of our ears. We were passing through the kitchen, and then the words several missiles, a missile attack.
New video from Iraq exclusive to Fox News and Fox and Friends this morning.
Our military taking out dozens of rockets pointed directly at the U.S. targets near Baghdad. But guess who supplied the weapons? Joining us now, the man who knows, from Operating Base Hammer, right near Baghdad, is Brigade Commander Colonel Wayne Grigsby. Colonel, I know you're in the middle of a sandstorm.
So you know, and then the story's gone. and we were going, we got to find out about this. So, you know, you quick run on to the Fox News website. There was nothing directly posted there. We went to the AP, Associated Press website, tried to find something about it there. And eventually, about 3 or 4 hours later, we discovered that indeed his main base had been struck by about a dozen missiles. We talked to him about 2 days later. And
you had to wait 2 days before you heard anything then?
Right, because you can't call your soldier. They're not allowed to have cell phones, and you can send emails, yeah. But they pretty much have to initiate the response.
I just want to be clear with this. You've got 2 days then of waiting and wondering if he's okay, injured, that
right.
sort of thing.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. 2 days later, he did call us, and for him, it was just a very sad experience because somebody was killed during that missile attack about 20 yards from him. But, of course, we didn't learn this until 2 days later when he called. And by then, he was already moving on to the fact that he was just getting ready to roll out, you know, on another night exercise. And so it was such old news to him that he didn't even really recognize, you know, the impact of mom and dad sitting at home going, oh, my God, was our son hit, wounded, killed.
Of course, he wouldn't know what makes the news back here either, right?
He doesn't know what makes the news. He doesn't. And it's because of the time difference, you know, everything is a little bit off to begin with. So he had just moved on to the next thing he needed to do.
I suspect you have a few internet bookmarks on your computer now, places
yes.
you know to check.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, you know, we have the base. I regularly run Google searches on the name of his main operating base to see if it's been in the news somewhere. We're constantly looking at footage and photos, like a lot of people around the country, just to see if our son pops up in one of them. I can't tell you how many times we drive up in front of our house nervous that there's going to be a military car in front of our house. With a military car in front of your house, it means there are two military people there to tell you that your soldier is dead.
You called him your soldier rather than your son.
Yes. I call him my son soldier. It's it's been a huge transformation for us over the past year and a half to become part of the military family. But we're very proud of what he's done, and he is a soldier. Very slowly but surely, he came around to the point that the best place for him to be at any given moment was protecting his brothers and sisters who were also soldiers. He did not think that the war in Iraq was protecting America.
I mean, based on what you said a couple of moments ago, I gathered that the two of you both have questions about the U.S. role in Iraq?
Yes. I mean, my questions are based, you know, from the easy chair of sitting in San Francisco Bay Area. His questions, of course, are based on the streets around Baghdad. I think he feels that over the time that he's spent there, which has been almost 14 months, that indeed the violence has decreased. But he knows there are still significant problems there. When he called recently, he talked about the fact that many of the so-called Iraqi peacekeepers or security forces are being paid by the United States. And he responds that those people, their allegiance is mainly to the dollar, not necessarily to the United States. And so he's concerned about when that goes, what are the Iraqi people really going to be able to do? He has seen storefronts reopen. He has seen people having much more access in and out of their homes and in some of the towns. And so there's been some real improvements. But he has serious misgivings about the loyalty of the Sunni security forces that we pay.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. One day, Steve Wright recalls, the phone did ring. It was his son at the nearby airport, home for a couple of weeks of leave.
When he came off the plane, I couldn't believe it. He thought that because he had his little armed forces debit card that he would be able to rent a car at the airport and drive it home and surprise us. But, of course, they don't rent a car to somebody who's 18 years old with just a debit card. So he was so I had to go. So he called me. He goes, "Oh, Dad, I was going to surprise you, but I'm stuck out here at the airport, you know, way out by the rental car place," because he had actually taken the bus to the rental car place thinking he had had it all smoothed out. But so there he was kind of standing. It was 11:30 at night. Nobody else was around. And there's the soldier. He was just there as a solitary figure. But obviously, it was just great seeing him.
How did he look?
He, you know, the amazing thing to me is that his spirits have remained very good. And so, I mean, he can smile, and all I can say is he looked fine. His sense of humor was still good. He jumped in the car. He actually offered to pay for some gas, which was a huge transformation for him and for us as a family, I think. And obviously, though, he's you know, stands much more maturely. He responds to questions in a more authoritative way, obviously, about the war and about the military. And the fact that when he visits with us, he actually makes his bed. He actually hangs his clothes in the closet. When he borrows the car, he returns it with gas.
Now, you had him into the newsroom.
Yes. When he was home on leave, the newsroom had responded to a request for some supplies to his platoon, and he was very grateful for the amount of beef jerky and socks and DVDs we sent him. I think we sent him almost 100 DVDs. So when he came back, I said, "Well, would you mind meeting with some of the reporters and editors? They'd really like to, you know, hear some firsthand experience." And he sat for an hour in one of the conference rooms, and it was basically like watching your son at a press conference, because he was surrounded by the reporters and editors, and they kept firing questions on him. What did he think about the war? What did he think about the killing that had gone on? Is it safe? How could he do it? And he really just handled those questions in such a way that my wife and I actually teared up, because he admitted mistakes that had been made, was still hopeful. It was just very refreshing and interesting to see your son become basically an adult.
How long was he home, Steve?
About 18 days. He married his girlfriend of 2 years. My wife is a Lutheran pastor, and she officiated for the service. We did it in our living room. They got to go on a brief little honeymoon, and it just came off very nicely.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As editorial page editor for the San Jose Mercury News, Steve Wright wrote a piece earlier this year. It began like this. One of the hardest things a parent can do is send a son off to war. The second hardest thing is sending him back.
Sending him back a second time was harder because we knew about the bombing of his base. We knew about the fact that one of the soldiers at his base committed suicide in one of the lookout towers. So we knew the personal toll it was taking on soldiers. We knew the difference just in daily life with, you know, when during the summer, it's 130 degrees and you're wearing 60 pounds of material. So he would talk about how he was literally dripping in sweat within 10 minutes of being outside. The whole existence there was just so much more horrible when you hear about some of these firsthand experiences that we just didn't want him to go back. So it was really hard the second time.
Steve Wright says his son is in Iraq now and due to come home at the end of this month. I'll talk more with him about how his opposition to the war and his son's service became a point of public debate in the San Jose Mercury News. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Until a few weeks ago, Steve Wright was in charge of the editorial page for the San Jose Mercury News. He just recently decided to take early retirement. He's my guest today, talking about his own opposition to the war, while his son is in Iraq as a cavalry scout with the Army. Now, this family matter became a little more public for the Wrights because Steve wrote first-person stories about his son's service and his own opposition. The newspaper also ran letters critical of Steve's position. One person wrote to say, "Your fear for your soldier son's safety is understandable. However, you do a disservice to him by your relentless vocal opposition to the war. Since a son is affected by the strong opinions of the father, your words could cause a moment of hesitation or distraction, which will put your son's life in danger."
Well, the most surprising aspect of the columns was getting those kinds of notes. Some of the vitriolic, deep hatred that some of those emails...
Oh, it was worse than that, wasn't
contained.
It?
Contained. Yeah, it was worse than that. Some people called us killers and so forth. But I must say that it was really only about 10% of the emails that expressed that general concern, that basically you can't be against the war and support the troops. But there is a huge number of people who feel very much that if you are against this war, you're endangering our soldiers. But I'll tell you, my son and I've talked with him about that, and he knows about my position. I mean, in fact, my wife and I fly an old-fashioned U.S. flag, peace flag, out in front of our house. And so he knows about it.
What's the peace flag? What does it look like?
It's like the old one you would have seen in the 60s. It's an American flag, but instead of stars, there's a peace sign.
Right.
In it.
Okay, I know it.
But as he has said a couple of times, that he is in the Army to help protect democracy, and he recognizes that vigorous debate about an administration policy, especially war, is essential to our democracy, and he's happy to have that kind of debate. I think he would enjoy actually being part of a real debate about it because I know he's studied up on it a lot. And so when people say that, it's hurtful, but I know a majority of people in this country, a vast, vast majority of people in this country, have no problem being opposed to this war, but still realizing it's not the troops' fault that we're there, and that many, many people are very thankful for the sacrifice that these soldiers are making.
And although Steve Wright has always disagreed with this war, he definitely admires his own son.
He is so much more passionate about something at an earlier age than I ever was. He has chosen to call his own shots very early in his life. And to me, that's just a remarkable... As a parent, I'm very just proud that he has seen what he wants to do and he has gone after it. And he's gone after it with gusto. I mean, he's not so rah-rah Army, you know, that he has a cavalry scout tattooed onto his back. But he knows what he wants to do, and he's gone after it. And that has encouraged me to not necessarily be so confident that journalism is what I need to do for the rest of my life. Maybe I need to try something else.
Steve Wright lives in Dublin, California. His son's tour in Iraq is due to end in a few weeks. Steve says his son, Private Wright, is scheduled to deploy back to Iraq in the summer of 2009. And you can read the columns that Steve wrote in the San Jose Mercury newspaper about the questions he faced while sending his son off to war in Iraq. They're on our website at thestory.org. You often hear me inviting you to submit your own stories for consideration here, and I'm delighted to say that a greater and greater percentage of the stories that we carry are ones that are volunteered stories that, well, we wouldn't find if it weren't for you. Today's is a love story, complete with all that indecision that precedes a relationship. It comes from Charles Matson Loom, and remember that last name, Loom. It's a part of the story. See, Charles had just graduated college and was trying to decide what he wanted in life. He had an inkling that he might want to be an artist, so he flew to the south of France to spend a semester at an art school there and ended up as a painting instructor. One of his duties was to pick up new students from abroad when they arrived in the neighboring town of Lumiere. That's when he met Sarah.
The very first time I saw Sarah, I drove down just like I would for picking up the rest of the students, and the streets, once you get into the village of Lacoste, are cobblestone and incredibly narrow, and most of the time, you've got an inch or two on either side. And I remember getting out of the car and then having sort of a brief conversation with her, and I was just sort of startled by it all. I think one of the things was her beauty, but I also had the sense that somehow I was opening up to this person in some odd way that I don't have any other really way to describe it, just totally in awe of this person. And the other thing that was striking was her voice, quite gentle and soft. And I think there was a kind of silence about Sarah that was palpable.
So I wonder, Charles, if this becomes awkward for you. I mean, you are clearly smitten by this person and trying to draw her out, but it sounds like she's very reticent, doesn't want to speak that much.
Yeah, I didn't even think about, this could be romantic. It was just sort of like being around her.
Yeah.
That was the most that I could hope for. And yes, I remember feeling this, being a fool, thinking that I was a fool to even imagine that this could happen. Her silence definitely created an awkwardness as well as my own sort of crush, if you want to call it. So those two things together just seemed like, oh, this is going to be hopeless.
Charles got to know Sarah slowly. She played the oboe, but she was quiet. He was told that she was curious about him, but he was still convinced that he was just another person passing through her life. Charles decided to paint a portrait of Sarah. She said she'd be honored. Soon after, Charles gathered up the courage to ask her to take a walk with him.
So the stars are out, the cicadas are going like crazy. I mean, it's very romantic. I remember her doing a cartwheel at one point and thinking the world has just turned upside down. And at some point in the walk, we were both in the dark. We're just sort of following the road by starlight. But nothing romantic in any way.
And I'm thinking to myself, Charles, that you have 6 weeks and she's going to go.
Yes, right. I'm trying to sort through things, but, I know that this is a doomed cause and that it's hopeless.
Why? Why hopeless? I mean, you have these starlight walks. You can tell her that you're smitten by her.
I guess I just don't operate that way. I need more time. And I had lots of relationships that were sort of long-distance relationships, and I was like, oh, I just don't want another one of those. I just kept remember thinking that I'm a fool.
All this while, Charles is preparing to make a painting of Sarah. He took her photograph, but he hadn't yet put his brush to canvas. Too soon, it was time for Sarah to leave.
I remember it was sort of raining, and it seems cheesy to think, oh, it's raining, and this person's going to leave that I'm enamored by. But I do remember this sort of green raincoat she had on, and putting her bags in the car, and giving her a hug. And it was a really startling kind of embrace. I think I was really surprised by its intimacy and how long it lasted. But then that was it. You know, we just said goodbye, and she got into the car and left. And I remember walking up the hill and just thinking, how did this happen? How did you let this person go? I remember thinking, somehow I've walked down the wrong path. I didn't know what to do about it, obviously.
You felt like you had let her go and you should not have let her go?
Yeah, right.
So tell me about painting her picture. When did you start?
Once she left, I had the photographs developed and then started slowly figuring out how I wanted to paint her. The first painting I made of her was enormous. I think it was 12 by 8 feet, and it was of her face.
My Lord, and that's an entire living room wall.
Yeah, to me it sort of mirrored the impact these 6 weeks had had on me, and somehow I had to get all that energy out of me. It was sort
big
of like
crush, a big painting.
Right, exactly. And it was mostly of her nose and her mouth. It didn't really capture her eyes. And while I was making it, I started a second one that was smaller. And
how many portraits did you do altogether?
Gosh, I don't know. I didn't count.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. We do have one of those portraits of Sarah. It's on our website. You can see it at thestory.org. Well, Charles moved back to the United States, and over the next couple of years, he continued painting portraits of Sarah. In spite of his obsession, though, their correspondence was sporadic at best.
I would receive a postcard periodically from Sarah, maybe like a Christmas postcard or something. Just
and you were writing her 6-page letters every week, or were you restraining yourself?
I wasn't writing her at all. I was putting all of the energy that I felt about her into the paintings, because I still didn't really have a sense that anything would ever happen.
You mean that she had any feelings for you?
Right. I didn't ever really have any kind of conclusive sense about it.
Did you ever send her a painting or a drawing or a photograph of the big painting?
Yes, I did. You know, she would write back saying, you know, I'm flattered and blah, blah, blah. But nothing beyond that. Very sort of spare. I mean, generous, but still spare. And nothing to give me any inclination that something would grow from, you know, painting her.
This woman is making you work, isn't she?
I know she is. It's true. Yeah. You know, I do it willingly, right? I'm happy to continue to make paintings of her. And I do feel like the paintings have a kind of honoring. That was sort of the main goal. And maybe they start to create a kind of presence in the absence of her being. The other reason why I sort of knew that it might be a hopeless endeavor in terms of thinking that she would see another way was that she was living in New York City and I was living outside of Chicago. And so there didn't seem to be any kind of, I'm going to move to New York or you're going to move to Chicago.
Charles Mattson decided to pursue his art studies and just happened to look seriously at a couple of graduate programs in New York. And he was pushed along by his friend John, who'd been watching Charles obsess about this mythic Sarah.
He sort of was helping me put my foot down and say, all right, let's take some action here besides the paintings.
And no, it's been 2 years since you've seen her at this point. What are you thinking? Yeah, are you thinking, no, I can't. I'm, you know, she only sends me postcards. What do I know?
Well, under the guise of the graduate school scenario, I felt somewhat safe.
I'm going to look at schools and I'll just drop in on her.
Right, right. There's that sort of safeness in the process. So John and I are sitting at a Baker Square and he gets up and this is the before cell phones. He gets up, I don't know where he goes, and he basically booked us two plane tickets to New York City. You know, God bless him.
I hear the butterflies in your stomach from here.
It's and I'm like, all right, we're going to do this. And the next day I called Sarah and I'm going to be in Manhattan. I'd like to see you if that's possible.
And?
You know, she was like, great. Do you and John want to stay at my place? And I was just like, oh my goodness.
You're going, great.
Yeah, sure. How many days can we stay? And when John and I arrived, it had been over 2 years since I had seen Sarah.
Had she changed?
She was as lovely as ever. To hear her voice, it was amazing. It was magical.
For her as well? I mean, are you now starting to get the kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think... I think there's something there. Basically, we were just going to see her once that night, and then I was going to take her out to dinner. And it turned out that she kind of played hooky from her job. She was working at Carnegie Hall, and she stayed with us the whole time. So when I got back on the plane and came back to Chicago, I was like, there's something that's happened. It's not just me anymore.
Charles was right. Sarah was more than just interested. The two of them eventually did get together. And they got married, which presented a new question for both of them.
Her last name is Sarah Erickson at the time, and my name is Charles Mattson. And we didn't really want to hyphenate our names. We had bantered around combining names, and it just seemed like a hopeless cause. But as artists, we both agreed that we should name this new creation. We felt like the marriage was a new creation, and it needed a name. It needed something. And so the new name, the name that we were going to add to our names, it took a long time.
It's like parents trying to name a new child, right?
Exactly, yes. I have two daughters. And, yes, long lists. And Sarah, being a musician, you know, was really keen on the sound of how the name should be. And I think as an artist, I was very keen on the meaning of the name. And we probably spent 6 or 7 months trying to figure out a name. And at some point, I was like, well, you know, we met in the south of France. Let's talk to Gustav, a friend of mine. Maybe he has some words. We had the idea that maybe it should be a Provençal word, the language of the troubadours, the first love poets. And he sends me back a list of about 10 or 11 words. And one of the words was loom. You know, we let it rest on our tongue and roll around, and it seemed to resonate. And it means light in Provençal. And it seemed to be a powerful word.
Well, you told me earlier that you met her first in this place called Dumière, right?
Which is I did. So it's funny that the village, the first place that we met, is sort of part of our surname now.
So it goes Sarah Erickson Loom, Charles Mattson Loom, right? That's how it works?
Right. And our daughters, Helena and Babette, their last name is Helena Loom and Babette Loom.
Do you think that changing your name in the way at the time that you did changed you at all?
I think that as it started to sort of soak into me, the oddest thing started to happen with my own art. You know, I'd been making paintings, and at one point, some of the portraits of Sarah were wrapped in lead, so they were kind of in a darkness. And when adding the name happened, I don't know really how it happened, but I started to not only paint paintings of Sarah, but I started painting paintings of objects like chairs or a walker or something like that. And what started to happen was that the shadows from the objects became really powerful. They in some ways became the image instead of the paint. And that transformation of the paint into shadow became a sort of pivotal point in that at one point, Sarah held up this clear object, yogurt safety seal. And she said, "Can you do something with this?" And I looked at it and I was like, oh, I think I could try, and put it on the wall. The object disappeared and this beautiful shadow emerged. And I think ever since then, my work is really, it's about light. It's about the properties of light. It's about how we experience light.
And do you think it was attaching that word that means light to your name that took you to that place?
I don't think I consciously said, my last name is Loom, and therefore I should be making art about light. I think it just happened naturally that I would grow out of this kind of darkness into the light. So in some ways I think about, that I sort of grew into that name.
Now, we did invite Sarah Erickson Loom to join us for the conversation, but being the silent type, she declined, so we are substituting the instrument that she is reputed to play so elegantly, the oboe. You can hear it in the background. Charles Mattson Loom is an artist in Chicago. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.